Thank you, Debbie. Thanks to, also to Wayne and Matthew for good introductions. This session was very well organized by the organizers. So I'm Greg Voth. I work in experimental studies of fluid flow, turbulence, and chaotic dynamics in fluid flows at Wesleyan University. But here at ASA, I'm going to try to step back and look at the bigger questions. We live in a world where there is an awful lot of popular discussion about science and religion. And one of the common themes that keeps coming up is that the rapid advance of science is explaining how the universe works, and so we no longer have need for religious explanations of our experience. And one of the common ideas behind that is the idea that the laws of physics that we know about don't have any explicit role for a divine intervention, and so therefore religious ideas have become less and less relevant. Now, many of us in the ASA have been trying to consistently point out that God's regularly upholding of the laws of physics is an important role of divine involvement in our worlds, but that opinion often gets drowned out in the very loud voices trying to look for the explicit violations of the laws of physics and looking for ways that God might be involved in gaps in our understanding of the laws of physics. So I have titled my talk today with a question, what violations of the known laws of physics do you expect? Exploring how complete are our known laws of physics and where might we be thinking that we're going to find violations. So as a touchstone for the talk, I'm going to take this title of a series of blog posts by Sean Carroll. Many of you probably know Sean Carroll. He's one of the prominent, he's a theoretical physicist and cosmologist from Caltech. He's been a prominent atheist, a voice in many of the discussions of fundamental physics and connection to religion. He's been one of the leaders of arguably the most influential, one of the most popular physics blogs on fundamental physics was Cosmic Variance, and now he has made his own at Preposterous Universe. But this is back in 2010 that he actually wrote this series of three blog posts titled "The Laws Underlying the Physics of Everyday Life Are Completely Understood." Now, when you see something like that, it's kind of a blog post, right? Intended to be a little bit inflammatory. But the natural response that comes to a claim like that is to quote A.A. Michelson from 1903, this is a published claim, "The more important fundamental laws and facts of physical science have all been discovered, and these are so firmly established that the possibility of their ever being supplanted in consequences of new discoveries is exceedingly remote." So this is 2 years before Einstein introduced special relativity in 1905, and his paper on the photoelectric effect really was a major piece of getting the quantum mechanics revolution started. I'm going to move that cursor out of the center of the screen there. And so this is often used as a kind of way to point out, okay, you arrogant physicists thinking you've got it all figured out, people have claimed this before and they've been wrong, and we should expect that we will continue to be wrong when we make these kind of claims. Kind of on that line, I put myself also back as a freshman at Wheaton College. I guess Dillard Ferris here was teaching me physics that semester, but I was also taking philosophy from Arthur Holmes. And after a question he asked in class, I gave my overconfident freshman answer, to which he responded with something that I've remembered quite often in my life, that you should be careful not to underestimate the strength of the arguments of your opponents. And I want to apply it here in a way that may not be the first thing you expect. I want to go back and look at Michelson's argument and see that he might be more right than many people give him credit for. So he claims that the more important fundamental laws and facts of physical science have all been discovered in 1903. Well, I want to use a metric for the more important laws of physical science as the laws that are used in engineering. So what does a mechanical or a civil engineer learn in their curriculum? And what fraction of it was known in 1903? I'm going to claim that it's 70, 80, 90% of what a mechanical or civil engineer learns was known then. Maybe a little less for the chemical and electrical engineers, but I bet over half of the curriculum taught in our physics, in our engineering schools was known before 1903, and so you can claim that Michelson was right if you look a little more carefully at the story underlying the situation. So let's go on and then try to take this apart. So the claim is that the known laws of physics let me quote it exactly. "The laws underlying the physics of everyday life are completely understood, and in order to get under that, we have to know what are the laws of physics that we're talking about." So the two fundamental theories that we use to describe physics is general relativity for the notions of things that are large or have large energy density, things like binary pulsars, black holes, and the universe itself. And this was discovered by Albert Einstein, basically working on his own in 1916. Our other fundamental model is the standard model of quantum mechanics that describes the behavior of small things like atoms, molecules, electrons, and quarks. And this was a much longer process to discover, discovered by many scientists between roughly 1900 and 1972. I think it's interesting to note this is the year I was born. Sean Carroll is a few years older than me. And there haven't been any experimentally confirmed advances in fundamental physics in my lifetime. And that's just an interesting point. The new generation has a little bit different viewpoint on this and probably some lack of perspective there. But it also is, again, been some years. You know, I've got plenty of gray hair to show for it. So then here's another diagram to give us a picture for how we apply these known laws of physics. Of course, vast oversimplification, as Matthew was telling us earlier, the laws of quantum mechanics are quite complex in our attempts to understand exactly what they mean. And yet when we calculate predictions for them for experiments and compare, we get very good agreement across the range of scales where we find quantum mechanics to apply. And here's a very rough range that where we have had success in applying the laws of quantum mechanics here in scales down to the subnuclear up through roughly millimeter scales, centimeter scales, where we have found successful predictions from the laws of quantum mechanics. The laws of general relativity extend out to the visible universe. These are the laws from which we derive the cosmology equations. And then we can extend them down roughly to 10 meters or something like that is the scale over which we can measure the change in the rate of clocks here on the Earth and show agreement with general relativity. Now, that's a problem. Because, as many people have said at this conference, these two theories are incompatible. And the fact that we have two fundamental theories that are incompatible with each other that we're using to try to describe our world and to claim that somehow we fully understand what's going on, it would be a big problem, except that we have this theory of classical mechanics that is the low energy density limit of general relativity and the high quantum number limit of quantum mechanics that spans the wide range in between them. So when we are working in this range, we almost always use classical mechanics, and then we rely on general relativity or quantum mechanics only when we need a deviation from one of those two. Okay, well, that's kind of basic stuff. I think many of the physicists are aware of that, but it gives us some background. So now let's try to take this apart. So the laws underlying the physics of everyday life are completely understood. So a few key words in this statement. First of all, underlying. The claim is that we understand the basic laws, even though we often don't understand their implication. So in Richard Feynman's lectures, he gives a very nice analogy to knowing the rules of chess. So I may know that a rook moves along the columns or the rows, and I may know that pawns only capture diagonally moving one space, but I still may not be very good at playing chess, right? So it's a very different thing to claim that you know the rules of chess or to claim that you're a grandmaster. And so there can be a very big gap between understanding the basic laws and understanding everything that we see occurring in the universe. And so that's a big caveat. We're talking about only the laws underlying everyday life. Now, everyday life is a slippery term. And this is the hardest part of formulating a thesis like this. You have to remove a list of counterexamples that we know we don't understand, things like dark matter, dark energy, the early universe. Notice that everyday life also removes some other things. The origin of life is not a part of everyday life. So this is no claim about whether we understand the origin of life. And as Christians, we might notice that the resurrection also isn't a part of everyday life. So the claim here is not explicitly saying whether resurrection is possible. It's just saying that the everyday occurrence, it wouldn't be an everyday occurrence. Okay, but it's still a strong claim, and many people reject it. The response he got on the blog was overwhelmingly critical of the claim, and I thought it was interesting to take it apart and see what we as Christians can think about this. Finally, the main problem with this statement, in my mind, is this statement completely understood. And I think Matthew's statement makes a clear point that nobody claims we completely understand quantum mechanics. In fact, Sean works on that subject, and he explicitly says in the more extended blog post that he's not at all claiming that we understand this in a deep philosophical sense. And so as a philosophical claim, this is simply wrong. But it is interesting as an approximate empirical claim. the claim that there is no new fundamental laws of physics that are going to be discovered that will significantly change the way we model everyday phenomena. Okay, so there's an attempt to make a somewhat charitable reading of what he's saying there. And so now here I come to my first main point, that when we look at a claim like this, it can be interpreted in two very different ways. And I think that Sean, in writing it this way, was kind of explicitly making it able to be interpreted in two very different ways. One of them is a philosophical claim about the completeness of the known laws of physics that have implications for reductionism and causal closure. I'm going to call that everyday naturalism, this philosophical claim. And the other, and this is the claim that has the most direct relevance to religious belief, the other, which is the one that he actually defends throughout the blog post, is instead an empirical claim about known models. Hopefully you have a good insight on how we scientists use models from the last talk, that known models accurately describe the motions of electrons and protons and planets and galaxies, so that future fundamental discoveries are unlikely to significantly improve our ability to model everyday life. So my summary for that version is going to be that no new fundamental models are needed. And the point I want to make is that, well, by combining these two, it's a kind of an effective rhetorical move, because you can explicitly empirically defend this one, which I think is quite defensible, and I'm going to argue that this is not such an unreasonable hypothesis, while many people drawing this conclusion from it. And I think that's in some ways the main problem with a claim like this. Okay, so let's keep going. So here's some critiques of that other people have given to the philosophical claims of everyday naturalism. And one of the main and substantiated, continued critiques of overconfident physicists, shall we say, by the philosophers of science has been that the known laws of physics form a patchwork and not a unity, so they only underlie parts of everyday experience. Now, this is a long discussion that is handled. These two books are the best sources I know of on them, but they're quite technical philosophy books. Steve Horst is a colleague of mine at Wesleyan, but Nancy Cartwright is the much more recognized name on this subject. And the point is not to take this apart, just to say that there are people who have thought very carefully about this claim of everyday naturalism. More accessible to many of us is Ian Hutchinson's book, Monopolizing Knowledge, in which he argues that this reductionist attempt to unite all of knowledge under science is inadequate to describe much of human knowledge, and so claiming that it underlies all of human life is just not an adequate philosophical claim. So I want to add a comment that came from the blog post that actually comes from the scientists. This will probably use to cut science funding. And I think it's interesting here that Sean has united a often disparate voices. Here are the philosophers of science being critical of the unity of science. Here are the scientific researchers trying to push forward the advent of science. And it's maybe the fact that these groups agree on criticizing this idea maybe gives us one hint why it's been hard for it to be taken seriously and considered what parts of it are true and what parts are not. Okay, so. Now, I want to spend the next part looking at the more empirical claim, that the models that we have are adequate to describe everyday life. And this is my attempt at a slide. I made it just this week, an attempt to capture the immense complexity of the world that we're trying to describe. I think one has to humbly admit that I'm not going to get this in a slide, right? But here's my attempt, and see whether you can get some grasp of the immense complexity of the world that we live in. So here on this axis, I've plotted size in meters. And I've scaled in only from 10 to the minus 10 meters to 10 to the 10 meters. Notice previously I went 10 to the minus 18 to 10 to the 26. So this is a smaller region, maybe more relevant to everyday life, but still a vast range, spanning from the scale of atoms up to the Earth's orbit. Down here on the bottom, we have some examples of amazing successes of our fundamental laws of physics. And Don Page nicely summarized some of them for us in a plenary lecture, so I'm not going to give any more many details here, but I just want to mention a few. So this electron, we measure its magnetic dipole moment to 11 digits, and it agrees with theory to 11 digits. It's amazing the kind of successes that we have with our theories of quantum mechanics. The hydrogen atom, my students measure 7 digits of the hydrogen atom spectrum in quantum mechanics class every year and show that it agrees with their non-relativistic theory. So Don mentioned the binary pulsar that has confirmed the gravitational radiation that is from general relativity. Here's the Earth's orbit the moon's orbit that were used initially in confirming classical mechanics and are among some of our most precisely measured quantities in classical mechanics. And let's just mention, since we're talking about everyday life, the global positioning system is now a way in which general relativity has entered your everyday life. You know this? That your cell phone only works because we can calculate the timing accurately enough with general relativity. So we do an amazingly successful job describing these things as long as they're not very complex. But this axis has a much wider range. I don't have a number to put on here, but just my intuitive sense is that there's a much wider range here than there is even here. We spend a lot of time telling people about the range of sizes in the universe. The range of complexities that exist in the universe are immense. So this is my research subject here. I work on turbulent fluid flows and particle transport in turbulence. There's a $1 million prize that's offered to anybody who can even prove that there are unique solutions to the Navier-Stokes equations, that are the equations of classical mechanics that describe turbulent fluid flow. You don't have to solve them. You just have to prove that a solution exists, and it's $1 million prize. And there's nobody who's expecting to win the prize anytime soon. It's an immensely complicated system. What's happening is that we are rapidly developing the abilities to solve the equations of classical mechanics. And in many simple turbulent flows now, we can calculate exactly what is going to happen simply by using supercomputers. So it's a problem that we're making good progress on, although complete understanding is very far away. So proteins folding is another problem here that I label that kind of roughly equivalent to turbulent flows, although at smaller scales, in terms of the kind of complexity. There are fewer degrees of freedom, but the quantum mechanics that describes the interactions between components of the protein are quite a bit more complicated. But I notice we still aren't to the systems that humans care about. We have to get out here to cells, things like the Earth's climate system, protoplanetary disks, just my guess of a few systems that people are working very hard on, but that current computational models are still require some significant approximations and are not starting from the fundamental laws of physics in their current models of these things. And now we finally get to the systems that the humans really care about. Things like human minds and social and economic systems and human morality that we heard about this morning. And the vast gap of complexity between these systems in which our fundamental theories are successful and the systems we care about is one of the main issues underlying any discussion of whether the fundamental laws of physics are adequate for describing everyday life. Okay, so I could keep talking here for a long time, but let's keep going. So I come to my second main point of the talk, and that is because of the extreme complexity of the systems that we care about most in everyday life, it is very difficult to empirically determine whether new fundamental models are needed. It's just when you ask about does the human mind require new fundamental physics, it's just very, very difficult to empirically determine whether or not that is necessary. But even if we are able to determine that, it's often not particularly useful to know whether or not new fundamental models are needed because we can't solve the models we have. What we really need are new emergent models, models that allow us to capture the main features of the complex systems without modeling all of their degrees of freedom, and it's not always clear that this is even possible. So there's the second main point that I want to cover here. Okay, so then, back to the question that I started with at the beginning of my talk. What violations of the known laws of physics do you expect? And maybe I can get some of you to propose what you think in the question and answer time. But here are some common proposals that people are expecting, that we may discover dark matter, that we may discover some other particles beyond the standard model that we need to include, that we may eventually get some kind of empirical understanding of dark energy. Maybe that quantum measurement will lead us to some new physics that will be interesting to us. A common feature about these is interesting to discuss whether any of these could potentially impact our modeling of everyday things. So if you go back to my complex diagram, we don't use anything about quantum theory in our turbulent fluid flows. We've already modeled it just with a viscosity, and it's already too complicated. for us to handle. And protein dynamics is very far from even considering the full electron cloud around the atoms. They're simply using effective interactions, usually in these cases. So we don't expect that if we discover violations of known physics for these four models, I think a lot of people don't expect that that's going to have an impact on the way we model everyday things. And I think the Wayne's talk about models is very important here, because it's how do we model? That's what matters. And I don't think that these are going to change the way we model any of the systems we care about. Here are the ones that everybody's focused on when we talk about what violations of known physics do we expect. Human consciousness might involve violations of known physics. Or that a spiritual realm exists that interacts with the physical universe in ways that violate known physics, which the philosophers call special, which the theologians call special divine action. Let me just briefly talk about those last two in the last few minutes here. So we do not have good empirical evidence for any violations of known physics that are relevant to everyday phenomena. I'm going to make that as a claim. I'm very interested in people who could make a counterexample to that. But the examples that Sean Carroll brings up are like precision searches for modifications to gravity and electromagnetism that have so far failed to find any deviations from the models that we currently use. And that every part of the brain that we're able to take apart and look at obeys known physics. Now remember, it's so complicated, this doesn't mean that the brain obeys known physics. It just means that as far as we've been able to look, we haven't been able to find any new physics in the behavior of the brain. So we're very far from an exhaustive search of these systems, but we haven't been able to find anything so far. So then, special divine action, miracles. That's a very hard one to work out. In some ways, it might not be expected to be repeatable in such a way that we could measure it and include it in our physical theories. And there are good theological reasons to think that God sometimes intentionally hides his interventions in the world from measurements. So even to the degree God is active in more than simply sustaining the laws of physics, it might be that we'll not be able to measure that in a way that would appear in our laws of physics. So the hypothesis that no new fundamental laws are needed in order to model everyday phenomena might be right. And I want to just say that my professional guess is that there aren't any significant violations of fundamental physics that we're going to find in the near future, or else I would drop what I'm doing and go look for them. Does that make sense? And I think that the church also isn't expecting fundamental violations of the laws of physics, or else the church would be funding the search for them. It would be one of the best apologetics approaches possible, right? And yet, these kind of claims that there are no new violations of laws of physics get used as arguments for atheism in ways that don't make any sense if people take them apart. So that, I think, is one of the main points that I want to leave. I'm not a theologian, but then the question of what implications there are for Christian theology is an important one we can talk about more. Now, time's basically up, so let me give you my last main point, and then we can have question and answer time. So if no new fundamental physics is needed to describe everyday life, I don't think there are any profound changes needed for Christian theology. God's ability to do miracles is consistent with his choice to act through the known laws of physics on an everyday basis. So here's my summary, which is just a restatement of the three main points that I've already given through the talk. If you want to look at them, you're welcome to review them, and maybe we can have questions.
One of the things that occurs to me in both these talks and the emergence talks that I heard yesterday is there's not a lot of talk about what we might call a non-reductive ontology, although that has been discussed. On this graph would pertain to suppose cells in the human brain, there are other laws that pertain to them that are not physics laws. Mm-hmm. Just other laws that are in the biotic realm and so on. Should we be talking about that as Christians, and is that something the reductionists will never...
It's a very interesting point. In some ways, I think my world in fluid dynamics is a great, simple case to think about that, because it's a case that we understand much better than this case. You know, we don't use the laws of quantum mechanics or general relativity. It's not even directly simple Newtonian mechanics that we use in fluid flows. We use the Navier-Stokes equations, which are an emergent law. You have to use the viscosity, which is an averaging over the behavior of many molecules, in order to even have the laws that we use here. So So totally, there should be new laws developing. The thing about the Navier-Stokes equation is that we can rigorously derive them from statistical mechanics. So there's no new fundamental physics involved in the laws of fluid mechanics. So in that sense, I would say it's exactly what we're looking for. And I think most of us would expect that those laws, in fact, that's what the sociologists work on, right? It just turns out to be really hard. There don't turn out to be really simple laws that describe social systems. So whether they will emerge or not, that's an interesting question. That's right, and that's one of the main points I'm making, that in some ways this isn't that useful, right? This claim that we know the rules of chess isn't very useful if you're competing against somebody else at a chess game. You actually have to have some experience using them. And similarly, knowing the laws of physics down here isn't very useful in describing human behavior. And so I think I agree with you with what you're saying there. Nevertheless, it is still a very interesting point, and there's a lot you can conclude about. You mentioned Sean Carroll's phase-based trajectory. There are some constraints on that are produced by the laws of physics, right? You know, conservation of momentum and the like. And so, there's insights there, but definitely not the whole story. Yeah, so I like to say that's above my pay grade. Physicists only deal with the simple questions, and if things get too complicated, we pass it off to somebody up the stream. So, I'm going to give you my actual answer to that question. I'm not too interested in the free will determinism debate because the mind is such a complex, chaotic system that there's no possibility of ever knowing the inputs and being able to predict the outputs. So the determinism claim just isn't interesting to me. But I know that's a minority viewpoint. The determinism claim seems to me to be one of these abstract claims that has no relevance to actually modeling the way humans behave, so I'm just not interested. I'm talking about, be careful about determinism there. There's a whole question about God's role in determinism. I don't want to be talking about that. I want to be talking about the philosophical determinism claim that somehow what we're going to choose is somehow determined by the laws of physics.
I just have a real quick response to that. I think Michael Polanyi's idea of levels that we can study at, and whatever you're studying, you can't simultaneously be dealing with other levels. So what's going on at an atomic level in the neuron is not related to choices. It's a different, you just can't possibly be covering all of it, and you can't explain human choice at the level of electrons. Does that make sense? Some of you, what did Polanyi call that?
Can I recommend a book on that topic? Out of MIT Press last year, the author is Michael Ulrich, C-T-S-E. I can't remember the exact title, but if you look on Amazon with that name, you'll find a book that does a really good job of addressing that. His name. His last name is T-S-E. First name, Peter Ulrich, U-L-R-I-C-H. MIT Press. I can't remember the title, but it addresses directly on that. I find him persuasively. He's not a theist, but he doesn't realize just how well his argument works.
It's called the neural basis of free will.
That's it, yeah, thanks.
So I thought this was a very interesting talk. It seems to me one of the problems that may be emerging for science and theology comes from this question that's suggested by complexity. What if the simplest representation of a system is the system? The human brain being an example. Is science possible as we know it? Now, I know people say, oh, Rob, we can do statistical averaging and yada, yada, yada. But the fact of sense, it would be a new gap for God theologically, because the universe knows how to do what it does. We're here, right? Mm-hmm. The brain knows how to think. The climate's doing what it's doing. Turbulent flows are flowing along. And we're trying to understand them, but if there really is this limitation, then what does that mean?
So, it's a good question, and I think it's the kind of thing I'm trying to hint at. Exactly. You know, the thing is, for the turbulent case, you know, is the turbulence itself, that's actually a good way to say it, the turbulence itself is the full system. You can't break it down. If you take the turbulence apart, it's no longer turbulent. And so you have to include the whole system in it. But we can still describe it and model it. And so, and we develop statistical models and all kinds of things. Yeah,
right.
We develop... Yeah, that's often the case. And we do experiments. The simulationists can't keep up with our experiments because it's much easier to do the experiment than it is to simulate it, often in these cases. But notice, here's another thing to point. In turbulent flows, if I get 2 digits, I'm really happy. Down here, they have, you know, 11 digits or whatever. And up here, we are guessing sometimes. So it gets harder really quickly as you go up here. And I think that's a barrier. I think it's widely recognized that it exists, but we don't often talk about it because you need funding, and so you talk about the next little step that you can make.
I was just interested in your comment, the response saying if no new laws of physics are going to arise relevant to everyday life, then, you know, funding agencies can cut off the funding. And the comment I would make is, that may well be true, no new laws of physics, but it doesn't mean to say no new physics, because mm-hmm. often the physics of everyday life precedes the laws. And so, to take examples, high-TC superconductors emerge, they've turned out not to be useful in everyday life, but they might well have been useful. We're still trying to think out the physics behind them. There's no agreement on that. Particles, carbon nanotubes emerge.
Absolutely.
But you know, the theory then develops after them. Gallium nitride, I work on, emerge, and it's a man-made material. Turns out theory follows the experiment. So in a lot of solid-state physics, the theory follows the experiment. Mobile phones have emerged and are continually improving. Computers emerge. There's new physics emerging based on existing theory. And so the funding agencies will want to fund these. They want to fund the new physics, even though they may not want to fund the new physical laws.
That's a very good viewpoint. He said it better than I will. But I say this often. I often say that people are looking for new physics up here and down there. And what we should be doing is saying that the new physics is out here. I work on complex systems, so maybe that's not surprising. But and I also find people saying that this isn't physics, or this isn't physics, or this isn't physics. And I don't know how to parse that. I don't want to claim that biology is physics, because they're the ones who need to solve these problems. But claiming that biology is not physics is a claim that I don't know how to parse. And so it seems to me that, yes, this is where we have to work, and this is actually, the funding agencies do know this already. There's very little funding provided to fundamental physics compared to the people who are doing condensed matter physics and biological physics and engineering physics. So
this has been a great session, really interesting interaction of ideas here. I would just add that we might not be discovering things about everyday physics, but discovering the interpretations of quantum mechanics is really exciting. My own field of dark matter and dark energy. There is so much that inspires the human spirit just to ponder these larger questions that don't impact our everyday lives. And perhaps then they do, how we relate to God and the questions we ponder. And the students all need to remember these examples about models. Feel free to contest the models that are prevailing and look for alternative experts. Anyway, thank you all and have a great lunch.